let's get busy here. The first thing that happens here that really struck me, and I'm sure it struck you as well, was God's presence coming back to Israel. I mean, now that Israel's alive, Israel's regenerated, for the first time since the two separate deportations, the two separate captivities, the entire nation of Israel is back together. And they're not only back together physically, they're back together in their devotion to God. Critical. So what happens? Well, the presence of God that Ezekiel saw leaving, and I kind of like the picture there, you know, the presence of God leaves, and then all the angels, you know, flap their little wings and kind of fly away. They just depart. That, to me, was just a terrible picture, because, like, last one out, turn off the lights. It was a terrible thing. So you can imagine when Ezekiel sees this image, I mean, he had to be pretty depressed at the last one. So when he sees this image of the glory of God coming back, what could have that meant to him? And when he told the Israelites about it, what did it mean to them? I mean, the hope that it gave them, the consolation. I mean, you can stand on your head in the corner if you know you only have to do it for 5 minutes. Well, maybe I couldn't. Not yet. But, you know, you can hang by your thumbs if you know it's for 10 seconds. But if you don't know how long you're going to be hanging by your thumbs, you're miserable. Well, that's kind of how this goes. They now have some consolation in seeing that their times of trial are temporary. And I always love it when he says, when you turn back to me. He doesn't say, if you turn back to me. It's when you turn back to me. So God knows it's coming. We just can't fool him. So I love it. And everything good comes out of the East, by the way. When you're reading Scripture, when you're looking at Scripture, East is good. Right? Moving east, going east, being east. You know, that's wonderful. Coming from the east means good. And in this case, it's clearly demonstrated by here comes the glory of God back from the east, the sound of rushing water, and the land is radiant. You know, his presence is so strong that everything in nature, which after all is his creation, radiates his glory. It was clearly seen here. I kind of thought question 13 was real interesting. It says, describe the temple so they'll be ashamed. Then it says, hey, let them think about it. And if they're ashamed, then tell them about the rest. And that's kind of a key to the Christian life for all of us. You know, when Christ was calling his disciples, did he sit down and give them the whole details of his plan? Did he tell them about his death, much less his resurrection? Did he tell them all the things they're going to have to do? No. He said, hey, follow me. I'll make you fishers of men. What'd they do? They obeyed. And they got the details as they needed. And that's what's pictured here in Israel. You know, they get the general plan. They're told, this is it. And then if they go, yeah, we buy into that, then they get all the details. Our Christian lives are the same way. We don't get the whole story up front. We don't get all that God has for us the minute we accept him as Savior. That wisdom comes as you grow. And we're going to see something later on in the lecture that really has to do with all of that process. This is kind of a picture of it. Hey, here's the plan. Obey. You get the details. With us, it's here I am. Accept me. Obey me. And you get the details. He doesn't say you're going to have them an instant before you need them. You're going to have them when you need them. It's just don't search for God's will. If you're studying the Word and obeying God, God's will find you. Your job is just to keep your feet moving, and that'll take care of the rest of it. Okay, I thought that was interesting. First, obey, then the details. Hopping along to the next thing I thought was fun, and that was number 17. Where we have this gate that's been shut, and it's shut because the Lord came in. Now, what was the key part of the gate that needed to be closed? The threshold needed to be closed. The doors needed to be closed. The gate itself was not closed, just the doors. You know, the gate, there's the temple. This is a gate, and this is a gate. And this is a gate. Notice how long the gate is. I mean, here's the steps, here's a pathway all through the whole gate, through the thickness of the wall, and here's a bunch of antechambers. So what was closed? Is the whole gate closed? No. Just the threshold right there. That's what was closed. Doors are closed. So this is going to be closed, and how long is it going to be closed? It's going to be closed all the time. Okay, all the time. So we find something interesting a little bit later. We find that there's a prince who can come and sit inside the gate. So how does he get there? Well, he comes in one of the allowable gates, walks across the courtyard, and comes in from the back. That's pretty simple. I don't know why it took so long for that to occur to me, you know, because my translation says he enters by way of the portico. Well, you know, I don't think of this as a portico. I have a different picture in my mind. So I had to sit there and kind of, what? He comes in one of the allowable gates and he walks in the back. And that's where he can sit and talk to God. Now, that brought up an interesting discussion in my group, maybe yours. Who's this prince? Right? And I'm pretty sure that 99.9% of people, when they read this first, their very first impression is, it's Christ. That's your first impression. By the way, did you know that not all translations capitalize all the references to Jesus? Some translations, if the hymn refers to God or Jesus, it's capital H. So this would have to be a capital P if it was referring to Christ. Not all translations do that, and there's a reason for that. Sadly, every translation has a point of view. It's done by humans. God helps us, but it's, after all, a human endeavor, and it comes from a certain point of view. Some people won't capitalize because they are not convinced which ones are which. So they say, let's err on the side of caution, let the reader decide. Other translators said, well, if it's real obvious who it is, we're going to capitalize it. And if it's not obvious, we're not going to capitalize it. So you have a little bit. So some of you were reading maybe translations where the P was small, and the rest of everything, all the pronouns and everything else in your translation are small. So that might not be a good clue as to whether or not it refers to Christ. But I will tell you in this case that it does happen to be correct. It's not Christ. As with everything else in Ezekiel, there are layers upon layers. Like an onion, you know, you peel it, and what do you find? You find, like, more onion. And with Ezekiel, that's exactly the way it is. Jerusalem and Israel had a prince in Ezekiel's time. Where was the king? The king was in exile. The king was gone, right? But there was still somebody in charge in Israel. And Ezekiel refers to him as the prince. Jehoiakim in Babylon got Zedekiah. And as a result, so on that level, there's a prince. But I think the main prince we're talking about in this scenario where we're talking about the temple is it's David. Now, why do I say it's David? Well, if you look at Ezekiel 32:23, he says, I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David. Doesn't say a guy like David, or someone after David, or, you know, it just doesn't say. It says, my servant David. So one of the strong views held on who this prince is, it's a resurrected David. Now, what's the golden rule of scripture translation according to Rod Longenberger and several other people? I didn't make it up. If the literal sense makes sense, then that's it. Don't go digging. If the literal sense of the words make sense, they're not allegorical, they're not metaphor, not any of those other weirdo little goodies that we can do with our little brains, then you have to read it that way. Well, my reading of it now, once again, remember what I said, can't be dogmatic about a lot of things in Ezekiel. And I am open to the conclusion that I may be incorrect in this prince being David. But this is not the only place. I mean, in Jeremiah 30, we have the same thing. In that day, declares the Lord God Almighty, I will break the yoke off their necks, tear down their bonds. No longer will foreigners enslave them. Said they will serve the Lord their God and David their king. Here it calls him a king. Other translations have it a little bit different. And then comes a key little clause in Jeremiah 39, whom I will raise up for them. Okay. I mean, when Jeremiah was writing, was David gone? Yeah, long gone. Long gone. So Jeremiah was saying, in that day, meaning in the future, David, whom I will raise up for. So the strong indications in the literal sense of both Ezekiel, David, and by the way, Hosea also refers to this. They all name David as the God. So I'm willing to believe it. It's like Pastor Frank said, how big is your God? You know, if your God's a real big, capital G kind of God, you kind of have to go with what he says. If he's a little g, kind of low kind of God, then you have to help him where he makes little mistakes. You know, and my comment has always been, any God that needs my wisdom to help him explain something is not someone I'm worshiping. I'm sorry. I mean, I might as well worship me. I'm helping the guy out, right? So I serve a big G God. I mean, I'm in that camp. And to me, he said it, and it seems fairly clear. So there you go. That's all the little discussion we had this morning. It's David, I'm sorry. Or someone very David-like. I'm open to the fact that I may be a little incorrect, but I don't think so. Or I wouldn't think so. Okay, let's move on from poor David. I think I've resurrected him several times. 19, I thought, started us on another really good topic when we started talking about Zadok. He's an interesting character. The line of priests that were in charge before Zadok was Ithamar. And because they participated in worship of idols, God said, you're out. Zadok's in. But that was not like the beginning of Zadok. Zadok had a relationship with David that went way back. The first time we see him mentioned is he's coming to David at Hebron. And in Chronicles, it's a discussion of Zadok and David and Hebron. And as a result of this, he got to be the ruler of the Aaronites. And so he goes on, he said, had very important things to do. One of the things that was mentioned by Ezekiel was, he was the guy Ezekiel sent to anoint Solomon. Because there was big controversy, right? Everybody pretty much thought Absalom was cool, and David said, no, he's not the guy, I'm sorry. And, you know, go anoint Solomon. And that was a pretty important feature. I mean, look at the impact that had on Israel, on history. That's a key transition, David to Solomon, for a lot of ways which you study. I mean, for a lot of reasons which you've studied. And as a result of that, he participated in one of the key moments in Israel's history. So this is a pretty important guy. He's apparently very faithful because David, a man after the Lord's own heart, entrusted him with a critical moment in the history of Israel. So Zadok, I think he's remained pure and his family was faithful. And as a result, they get to take over the jobs that had traditionally been done by the other families of the Levites. That must have been hard. You know, notice what God does here. He says, well, you've got to suffer the consequences of your sin. Okay. So you look at it and you think the consequences of their sin is they don't get to do the things they used to do. But to make his point with an exclamation point rather than just a plain old period, God makes them still serve right outside. So what do they see every day? They see the line of Zadok. going in to do what they used to do. They have to watch these guys. Because, see, they're serving all around the periphery, right? They're still allowed to serve, but they're allowed to serve, like, out here. Zadok's guys get to go in here. And who do they walk by when they're going in there? All of the priests that could no longer perform God's service. That had to be hard. I mean, just the fact that you didn't have to do it anymore had to be hard. You weren't allowed to do it. But the fact that you had to be in close proximity every day and see those who were doing it, that has to be hard. You know, a disappointment happens, what's the easiest thing to do? Cut and run. That way you don't face it, you don't see it. You're not constantly irritated by the fact that you can kind of shove it to the back of your mind. Not so much. Every day they had a little another reminder of the fact that they were no longer what they should have been. And they could have been there. So I think there has to be some amount of regret piled on this. So I see the God's little consequences that he said they were going to suffer as being two layers. One is they can't do what they were going to do, but they have to kind of wonder and sit and watch and think, gee, that could be me. I could be doing the important stuff. So, does that have an application for us? Yeah, you bet. Big time. Big time. I mean, we can disqualify ourselves from our primary service to God if we don't live up to our responsibilities as Christians. So once again, we have Israel kind of picturing us. Unfortunately, it's much too accurate a picture of me. I mean, you know, they were stiff-necked and tough and kept falling on their noses, and then they'd get up and God would take them back, but things were different. And unfortunately, that's the story of my life. I mean, you know, so you screw up and things happen and there you go. But in all of it, God is still our God. We are still his children. He still wants the best for us. So the fact that we have to live with the consequences of the things we do, that's just how it is. One day all those regrets are wiped away. So there you go. Okay, now we get to a real interesting part. Part about, we're talking about the duties of the priests. How we had some sacrifices and how they'd be reinstituted. And the main question here becomes one of, why is there an altar? Why are we doing these sacrifices? Didn't Christ die? Isn't all this done? So what's the deal with this? I mean, my view of Scripture is that Christ was the literal fulfillment of every single feast of Israel, some of which have not been fulfilled yet, by my reckoning. By other reckoning, yes, to mine, no. So why are we still celebrating these crazy feasts? And which are the three that are picked out to be celebrated? Well, it's kind of odd. They're the very first two in the liturgical calendar, and then the very last one. And the three kind of, you know, numbers 3, 4, 5, and 5 are gone. 1, 2, and 6 are left. And why was that? Well, there's a couple ways that you can look at it. And I think the best is we do communion. We have communion. And what do we do in communion? Why are we doing it? To remember Christ's sacrifice for us, right? His body and his blood. He's killed and his blood is shed for us. And we do that to remember, to focus ourselves every so often on that fact. And there's a good possibility that that's exactly what these celebrations are. They're a way that Israel commemorates what they now recognize as their Messiah's role in their history. They finally get it. Their minds are opened, and they say, yeah, he's the guy. How come we didn't know that before? And they institute a method of remembering. There's no other cognizant explanation. I mean, there are other explanations, but to me, they're just irrational. There's one way to think about this, and it's a traditionally Hebrew way of listing things. And one of the ways they list things is they list the first thing, they list the last thing, and everybody knows it includes all the rest of the things in the middle. That's a prominent viewpoint. Because we have the first two and the last one, there are those who say the rest of the feasts are still celebrated. But they're not specifically listed. I don't believe it. It's a common area of literature to say that. I just don't believe it. So, we're going to do Passover, we're going to do Tabernacles, and we're going to skip some of the other stuff in between. The first thing they do is purify the altar. I mean, they build it, then they purify it. And the purification is much in the methodology of the old Levitical system, where they have a heifer, and they start with that, and they go through the steps with the blood, and they make the altar pure, so that then it's prepared for the sacrifices. And I think, to me, that's a picture of God working through his new covenant with Israel. The fact that there's a new set of rules. Now they get the point. And so it's a connection between the Levitical process that was taking place prior to this and the new process that they're going now. It's a link. It's something to connect them to their history. And it's much in the manner of how we do communion. There's a lot more that could be said about that, but to me, most of it's speculation. I don't really want to get into that too much more. That brings us to the really good part. To me, this is like one of the excellent parts, and we're getting down now to the water. The question came up in our group is, you know, like, what temple is this? Is this a temple that's been built and is now gone? Or is this something different? Well, to my point of view, this is something very different. There's never been a temple with a river flowing out. You can look back at all the historical temples, and it's not happening. There's no temple with a river flowing out of it. Second thing is, this temple's furniture is way different from previous temples' furniture. You know, all of the internal furnishings of the temple, and you can see there's a sanctuary floor plan kind of up at the top there. And if you look at it, you find that there's temple walls, there's the outer place, there's the Holy of Holies, there's the holy place. What isn't there that was there, say, in Solomon's temple? All of the furniture's not there. You know, lampstand, table of showbread, mercy, all that stuff's not there. Incense altar, it's not there. There has never been a temple of Israel without those things in it. Through history. I mean, you can read not only the scriptures, but you can read the secular histories of the time, Josephus and others, and you find out that those temples all had that furniture, and this temple doesn't. So as a consequence, it's pretty clear to me that despite the best efforts of some to make this something that's happened in the past, that it hasn't. It hasn't. And I think it's going to be pretty clear when we see the river flowing out of here causes something that has never happened. The most ancient writings we have about the Dead Sea are that it was dead. You know, all the ancient historical writings of any people that ever wandered through here and wrote anything down said dead. Not only dead, but the water was dangerous. You know, it would kill you, and it will. you know, just the somewhere between a pint and a quart of this stuff will kill you. I don't know if you've ever been in it. My analogy is diesel fuel. Of course, most of you may not ever have touched diesel fuel. You don't know what that's like. It's greasy, it's thick, it's icky. Well, this is like sitting in diesel fuel. It's bad. The second time I was there, a lady decided she wanted to do a little swimming. And she got in there and actually turned over to do the crawl. Bad mistake. You're so far out of the water, it's almost impossible to turn the other way. And while you're trying to do that, you're splashing that stuff in your eyes. We had to go out and drag her in. I mean, it was brutal. The stuff is just awful to the taste. Just little taste is more than you'd want. One guy walked in who had some scratches on his leg from some hiking we did the day before. He lasted about 20 seconds. That stuff got in those cuts, and it was just brutal. But this sea has been dead a long time. Dead a long time. Well, what happens in our little picture here of the temple? What happens to the river from under the temple, right? Notice, here, in the center of this Levite section, is where the sanctuary is. Now, where's Jerusalem? Current Jerusalem, where is it on this map? Is it up here? Not up there. It's down here. Down here. So, what does that mean to us? Does that mean this sanctuary may not actually going to be in Jerusalem? You know, hard thought. It's a hard thought. It's a very hard thought. But what do we get as a description of the river that comes out? Where does the river flow first? Flows out of the south side of the temple, but which way does it flow? East, right? It goes east. And where does it enter first? Maybe that didn't come out. It enters the Rift Valley first. And then it flows down into the Dead Sea. Okay, so if it's going to flow east, it's going to flow into the Rift Valley. Is it starting out from here? Not too likely. Not too, a little bit confusing, but not too likely. Okay, not too likely. What happens where this water goes? First of all, when it flows out, does it just kind of trickle out? No, it gets deep, and it gets deep fast. I mean, they're measuring off these little rods, and it's like ankles, knees, hips, over your head. River no one can cross. So there's a volume of water coming out of here. A volume of water is coming out of here. And what happens wherever the water goes? Trees! What do we know about... Now, Marcy has drilled you guys and grilled you guys. What do we know about, like, this area through here? What is that called? It's the wilderness, right? It's pretty dead. If you've ever traveled out this way, it gets dead real fast, too. It's like there's somebody drew a line in the mountains and said, here you shall have water and here you shall not. You could stand on both sides at some places. So everywhere this thing goes, there's trees. What do we read about the Dead Sea? What's happening in a Dead Sea? They're fishing. They are fishing. Now, this sea up here, Sea of Galilee, Kinneret or whatever, whichever term you want to call it, has been good fishing, and it's been good fishing for a long time. But this sea down here, not so much. Not so much. But there's fishing in there. So what does it tell you about this water? It brings life. It's fresh water. It brings life. Here's something I really wanted to get to, and I'm going to make. You can look at this in a number of ways, a great number of ways. I'm just going to give you a couple of ways to look at this water in this river. First of all, you can apply this water, it's getting deeper and bringing life, to the revelation of the plan of salvation. It started with the patriarchs, it went to the giving of the law, it went to the ministry of John the Baptist, It went to the full manifestation of Christ, his death and resurrection, and that was when the gospel was finally pretty much intact. And it just kept getting wider and wider and wider as the revelation of God came to humans. And that's kind of like what this water does. Second thing, growth of the personal believer. Starts out as a little bit of the seed of the kingdom, falls in your heart, kind of grows up into a blade from the seed. Then you get fruit from the blade. Then you get like the little tassels and stuff, like corn. I'll use corn as an analogy. Then you get the full cob of corn. And that's kind of like we are. We start out with a little seed in our heart. When we accept God, the gospel's thrown on us. We accept it. The seed starts to grow. The little baby Christians, kind of stupid and blundering about, but very enthusiastic. You know, it's like, think of a little child. What do? A lot of them. Well, they scream. They do this. They do that. They fuss. They get mad at you. I mean, it's just all these little things. And baby little Christians do that. They're full of enthusiasm. They're kind of bumping into the walls, trying to walk, trying to get moving. Then you're mature. You become a more mature Christian, and you start to throw out the seed yourself. You start to reproduce. I don't think we could become the full ear of corn till we go with God. That's when we're finally, like, completed. So the river could picture that. Could also be a type of the progress of Christianity. How did Christianity start? The basics of it as far as the gospel. It went to some fishermen to start, some poor fishermen. There were Jesus and a couple guys in the club, right? Then what happened next? After that, it kind of spread to the Jews. I'm sure they thought of it as a Jewish cult. Oh, here's these followers of the way. Oh, boy, look at them. Aren't they a little weird? You know, probably tolerated at first, but then not so much tolerated later on, so it went to the Jews. Then what happened? Then the Gentiles got it. You know, Paul got in the picture, things happened, boom, and things blew out, and the Gentiles got it. And, you know, it spread to like Asia Minor and Greece. And then it went to the main continent and the Isles of Europe. And now it's difficult to find a place in the world that has not been touched in some way with the gospel. Not, I mean, it's not everywhere. If it were everywhere, we probably wouldn't be here anymore. But it's getting close. I mean, so this river spreading out and bringing life is kind of a picture of this, of the gospel. As it goes, it brings life. So I guess my point in all of this is, when you're reading prophecy, especially when you're reading Ezekiel, you have to understand that there's more than one layer. I mean, in class, I loved the question when we went around about this water, because Lynn had us go to everybody. And I was just sitting there going, ha, ah, yeah, they get it. I mean, a few people said sort of the same thing, but then there were others who had a different fix on it. And the beautiful part of that is every single one of them was right. Different, but right. And that's kind of the way Ezekiel is. You keep peeling at him, you're going to find something else. And that's why he's a little, I have to admire Marcy's fortitude in going through some of this prophet stuff in the Old Testament. I mean, I personally have an affinity for it and a great love for it. But there are many people who won't even read it because it's hard. It's too hard. Who's the prince? How can he get in the gate? Who's this one? I mean, you could drive yourself crazy. I don't want to make your head too big, but it's pretty awesome that you're willing to plow through this stuff. I love it. Most people flee from this like crazy. So, wherever the river goes, there shall be life. There shall be life, just like the gospel. Wherever the gospel goes, there's life. There should be a great multitude of fish. Oh, by the way, it's interesting about the trees. They're dual-purpose trees, as trees always have been. Their food and their healing, their medicine. I mean, aspirin is the bark of a tree. And if it were discovered today, it would be prescription only, I guarantee you. I guarantee you, if that came out now after the trials, you'd have to have a prescription for it. Because it's an amazing thing. Lowers your temperature, eases pain. Now they're finding out it has heart benefits. I mean, this is from a tree, and it's pretty much from the tree today. Acetyl salicylic acid from the bark of a tree. These trees are going to be that way. They're going to be for food. They're going to be for healing. It absolutely blows me away. Now, the last thing I intended to get to, and that's a good thing, because we're going to have to go fast, is the allotment of land. Notice that's kind of a goofy order. It's not at all like it used to be. Look at them. They're all over everywhere. They're on the wrong side of the Jordan. Well, not really, because where does Israel actually go? The Euphrates, and where's that? That's Sodom's backyard. I mean, yeah, that's where it is. You know, they've been down here in Sinai. They've had that all the way to the Nile. Well, sort of. Not quite. But they gave it back for peace. What a joke that was. You know, and that was 1982 when they gave the Sinai back. Supposedly for peace. No more land. I'm sorry. Palestinians, get a life. You're not getting this land back. I'm sorry. It's just the way God said it, so it's going to be. From the Nile to the Euphrates, Israel. Okay, here's where they used to be. Kind of mottily spread all over the place. Here's how they are now. And there's actually some sense to this. Just briefly, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, way, way up there. How come they're up there? Well, they're sons of Jacob by his concubines. God's in it, but they suffer the consequences. You know, they're pretty far from the action. It's kind of like being in Petropavlovsk, Russia on the East Coast, and they don't worry about Moscow out there because Moscow is way, way far away. Manasseh's not split in half anymore. Not split. Manasseh's back together. Ephraim, hey, north of Reuben, doesn't dominate the land like it did anymore. Remember way, way back, Ephraim and Israel were synonyms? Right? You kind of get them a little bit, God would throw them in there in the thing and kind of look at them, who's he talking about now? Well, it's Israel. Well, not anymore. Sorry, he's been a little bit demoted. Reuben, oh boy, incest, instability, no distinguished priest, prophet, or king ever came from Reuben. But as the firstborn, he's closer to the middle than others. But he messed up. Could have been the guy. Then we get down to Judah and Benjamin. What do we know about Judah and Benjamin? What were they? Southern kingdom, right? Southern kingdom. They remained faithful the longest. So they're right there in the action. They get primary spots. Right by where all the action is. Then we got Simeon. Moses didn't bless him in Deuteronomy 33, and it was overshadowed by Judah to the north, but gets to be just below Benjamin. Gad, Leah's handmaid, Zilpha, bore Gad for Jacob. So he's kind of down at the bottom. So we got the concubine kids, bookends. And then, you know, other kids in the middle. God has such a sense of humor that I just love him. You notice right here on the sides of the city, there's like land and land. What did it say about that land? Common use, right? Common use for the city. And all I could think of was Irvine Greenbelt. You know, hey, first planned city, not a chance. Okay, you got Green Belt concept right here. So Irvine is a very scriptural place, and you're lucky to be here. Enough. Okay. That's kind of an interesting thing. But once again, remember that this is where the sanctuary is. And the river flows east and down. By the way, all of the Dead Sea does not come back to life. There's two main springs in the Dead Sea on Gettys right about here. And then there's another one up here that's identified, and I can't remember the name of it because it's not that common. En Gannim. It's hard to figure out exactly where that is, but the construction of the name, it would have been up somewhere in the north here. So between that spring and En Gedi, this will be fishable. South of here, there will still be salt marsh. We're not told a lot about that area, but we are told that to En Gedi, things are going to be hopping. One other thing I wanted you to see, where'd that thing go? It was right at the last part of Marcy's lecture. The Lord is here. The Lord is here, right?
There.
Yeah, there. City. Yeah. Well, if you're living there, it's the Lord is here. And by the way, the very opening thing about I was carried there on a mountain, and there was a city to the south of it, notice it's not identified as Jerusalem. We jump to that assumption, and I jump to it at first myself, but I don't think it actually is. This is a blow-up of that little stripe through the center, and right there is the sanctuary, dead in the middle of the priest portion, and this is Irvine here. Priest setup, right? We're clear on that. And then you've got the other poor, deprivileged persons living here in this ghetto. Okay. So, you know, Ezekiel, there's so much there. I mean, if you can stay another, like, couple of hours, we'll figure this out. I hope I've given you a little bit of flavor of the layers, the multiple interpretations. Very few things in Ezekiel are of one interpretation. Lots of them are hardly of two. There's usually three layers minimum of things you can think about. So when you're bored, you know, this is a good place to come if you want to be mentally stimulated in the extreme.